From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Doha, Qatar, as we join you from the headquarters of Al Jazeera. We take a look at the Arabic TV network with Dr. Faisal Al-Qassem. He's head of host of the Al Jazeera program, The Opposite Direction, one of the most popular shows in the Arabic world and the most controversial. We'll also look at the channel's origins with Hugh Miles, author of Al Jazeera, How Arab TV News Challenged the Word, the World. And we'll speak with Al Jazeera correspondent Ahmed Mansour. He covered the U.S. assault on Fallujah, April 2003, was beaten while covering the elections in Egypt. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, Republicans scored a major victory Wednesday with the slim passage of a budget bill that slashes billions of dollars from health, education, and welfare programs. The bill will impose fees and scale back benefits for millions of low-income Medicaid recipients. A recent congressional study predicted the bill would deny medical services and drugs to millions of low-income Americans unable to afford the new premiums. The vote passed by a margin of 216 to 214. 13 Republicans joined all House Democrats in opposition. The Senate has already approved the bill, with Vice President Dick Cheney casting the decisive vote in December. Republicans hailed the bill for cutting nearly $40 billion from the federal deficit, but the Washington Post notes its impact is likely to be negligible, slicing less than one-half of 1% from the estimated $14.3 trillion in federal spending over the next 5 years. The Los Angeles Times observes the spending cuts are more than offset by the $56 billion tax cut passed by the House last year. The Senate's currently debating that measure. Taken together, the two bills would result in adding $16 billion to the federal deficit. Meanwhile, the House approved a measure Wednesday to extend the USA Patriot Act until early March. The vote marked the second time in just over a month Congress has granted the act a temporary reprieve. A long-term extension has been held up over bipartisan concerns the legislation lacks adequate safeguards for civil liberties. In other news, the White House is refusing to comply with a Senate Judiciary Committee request. It hand over its own legal opinions on President Bush's domestic spying program. According to the New York Times, Justice Department officials said the opinions were irrelevant because the administration has already publicly laid out its legal defense for the program. But Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York, who serves on the Judiciary Committee, said, quote, without the Justice Department memos and without more witnesses, it's hard to see how anything other than a rehashing of the administration line is going to happen. I am worried that these hearings could end up telling us very little when the American people are thirsty to find out what happened here, he said. The committee is set to hold its first public hearing on the program on Monday. Meanwhile, a civil liberties group is suing telecom giant AT&T over its alleged role in assisting the National Security Agency spy on the phone calls and messages of U.S. citizens without court warrants. The suit, filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, known as EFF, in U.S. District Court Tuesday, claims AT&T provided the NSA with extensive access to its networks and databases. EFF attorney Kevin Bankston said, quote, our main goal is to stop this invasion of privacy, prevent it from occurring again, and make sure AT&T and all other carriers understand there are going to be legal and economic consequences when they fail to follow the law. Just one day after President Bush drew headlines for pledging to reduce the country's reliance on Middle Eastern oil by 75% by the year 2025, two top administration officials said Bush's promise was not meant literally. In a conference call with reporters, Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman and told reporters the president was giving, quote, purely an example when he spoke about making dependency on Middle Eastern oil a thing of the past. Bodman, speaking alongside presidential advisor Dan Bartlett, said President Bush really meant that alternative energy could take the place of the amount of oil the U.S. is expected to import from the Middle East in 2025. An administration official told Knight Ridder the president used the words the Middle East only so he could illustrate the issue in a way that, quote, every American sitting out there listening to the speech understands. In other news, the oil conglomerate Royal Dutch Shell has announced annual profits of over $22 billion, the most ever for a company listed in Britain. The announcement comes just days after rival oil giant ExxonMobil reported a record-breaking $36 billion profit, a sum larger than the economies of 125 countries. In Iraq, USA Today is reporting the U.S. has failed to open any health clinics in the country, despite initially promising to open 180 clinics by last December. Iraq's deputy health minister said the U.S. has completed construction on only 4 clinics. Back in the United States, a nonpartisan congressional investigative body has singled out the Department of Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff for the government's bungled response to Hurricane Katrina. In a preliminary report, the Government Accountability Office said, quote, "We continue to believe that a single individual should lead and coordinate the overall federal response in the event of a major catastrophe." The report went on to say neither the DHS secretary nor any of his designees filled this leadership role during Hurricane Katrina. In West Virginia, Governor Joe Manchin has called for a statewide moratorium on all coal mining after 2 miners died Wednesday in separate incidents. The moratorium will be in effect until inspectors complete thorough safety checks at the mines. Governor Manchin said, quote, "We're going to check for unsafe conditions and we're going to correct any unsafe conditions before we mine another lump of coal." Wednesday's deaths brought to 16 the number of mining-related fatalities in West Virginia already this year. In Los Angeles, the FBI has launched a civil rights investigation into a police officer caught on videotape shooting an unarmed African-American veteran of the Iraq War. The incident occurred Sunday night. Elio Carrion, an Air Force police officer, was riding in the passenger seat of a vehicle that failed to pull over on police orders. The vehicle then crashed outside of a nearby home. On the videotape, Carrion is seen following an officer's demand to get up off the ground, but is then shot 3 times. He's reportedly in the hospital in good condition. The police officer has been put on a temporary leave of absence. One day after Cindy Sheehan was arrested for wearing an anti-war T-shirt to President Bush's State of the Union address, Capitol Police have dropped the charges against her and apologized. Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey, died in combat in Iraq in April 2004. She was removed from the House gallery Tuesday night after unveiling a T-shirt that read, "2,245 dead and how many more?" a reference to the number of U.S. service members killed in Iraq. In a statement, Capitol Police Chief Terrence Gaynor said Sheehan should not have been arrested. President Bush began his speech shortly after she was removed. And in Greensboro, North Carolina, 7 protesters are facing charges after being arrested Tuesday night during a State of the Union protest. The protesters reportedly got into an altercation with an undercover police officer who was photographing protesters. The Greensboro demonstrators were among 68 protests held around the country Tuesday night, calling on Bush to step down. The main group behind the protests, World Can't Wait, is also organizing a protest on Saturday in Washington. We are broadcasting from Doha, Qatar. Those are the headlines. We are attending here the 2nd Al Jazeera Forum, a gathering of journalists, scholars, and media makers from the Middle East and around the world. It's being held to discuss new political, legal, and technological challenges facing news organizations and to debate the responsibility of the media in an increasingly fractured world. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The forum here in Qatar was organized by Al Jazeera, the Arabic satellite television network headquartered here. Al Jazeera first began broadcasting in 1996 and has grown to be the 5th most powerful brand in the world, this according to brandchannel.com. Over the years, the network has come under intense criticism from governments around the Arab and Western worlds and from across the political spectrum. Some leaders in the Gulf have objected to Al Jazeera's presentation of views critical of governments in the region, and members of the Bush administration have claimed the network is biased against the U.S. and its policies. In fact, in August of last year, the U.S.-backed Iraqi government banned the network from reporting in Iraq. Al Jazeera has also been the victim of U.S. military attacks. The U.S. bombed Al Jazeera's bureau in Afghanistan in November 2001, Baghdad in April 2003. Al Jazeera correspondent Tariq Ayoub was killed in the Baghdad attack. The U.S. claimed both bombings were accidental. Then last November, the London tabloid, the Daily Mirror, cited a secret British memo allegedly revealing that President Bush told Tony Blair in April 2004 of his desire to bomb the news outlet here in Doha, Qatar. Bush administration officials dismissed the report, calling it outlandish. Well, here to talk about the origins of Al Jazeera is Hugh Miles. He's the author of Al Jazeera, How Arab TV News Challenged the World. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much indeed for having me on the show.
It's great to have you with us, Hugh. Well, why don't you start from the beginning? How did Al Jazeera begin? And actually, first, why did you end up writing a book about it?
I wound up writing a book about Al Jazeera because I was working for Sky News in the UK, which is the sister company to Fox. It's owned by Rupert Murdoch as well. I was working there during the invasion of Iraq for 3 weeks, starting in March 2003. And my job was watching all the other TV news channels to make sure that Sky didn't miss any hot pictures, because this is a standard practice for TV organizations. So I was watching not just Al Jazeera, but also the BBC, CNN, Abu Dhabi TV, French TV, Reuters, and so on. But I'm an Arabic speaker, and so as the war developed, I found myself focusing more and more on Al Jazeera, simply because they had so many exclusives, they had journalists in places nobody else had journalists, and also because I noticed that there were important differences between the war that I was watching on Al Jazeera and the war that was unfolding on BBC and on CNN. So I wrote an article about it, which was published in the London Review of Books, which is a periodical in the UK. And the article kicked up quite a fuss because Al Jazeera was already a household name at this point following 9/11 and the Bin Laden interviews. And I realized in the wake of the article that there was a lot more digging to be done, because all my questions, who had started this channel, who financed it, who owned it, did it know where Bin Laden was? Was it in league with the insurgents in Iraq, as Donald Rumsfeld claimed? All these questions, no one could answer. And there was a lot of smoke and stories about Al Jazeera, but the facts were elusive.
So how did Al Jazeera begin?
Al Jazeera started in 1996. It was introduced by the emir of Qatar, who's the ruler of Qatar, this country where we are today. He had obviously decided... When he came to power, the year earlier in 1995. He came in a coup, he overthrew his father, and it was perfectly clear that he had been planning this new channel for some time. The emir is a new breed of Arab ruler. Unlike the older rulers in this region who are in their 70s or 80s, the emir was educated in the West. He was at Sandhurst Military Academy. He was a much younger man. He was only 44 when he came to power. And when he came, he brought with him a bunch of Western-educated technocrats who genuinely wanted to do something different. And he started Al Jazeera shortly after he arrived, and first broadcast began November the 1st, 1996. The first year was pretty quiet because Al Jazeera initially wasn't receivable. You needed to have a very large satellite dish because they couldn't get the transmitting spot on the satellite that they needed to be available in the Middle East, and most Arabs don't have the big satellite dishes. So the first year slipped by without anyone really noticing much about it. And at the same time, there were lots of other Arab satellite stations starting up as well. But then following an interesting mishap at the satellite, where what happened is Al Jazeera wanted to be broadcast on a more powerful signal so that ordinary small satellite dishes were sufficient for getting the signal. But the problem was the satellite was fully booked up, and Al Jazeera was trying to get a space. They couldn't get one for months. And until Canal France Internationale, which is a French channel, accidentally broadcast a hardcore pornographic movie one Saturday afternoon, which was received by some 33 million Arabs in the Middle East region.
And this was in the middle of a children's program?
This was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the middle of a children's program. And the satellite, which is called Arabsat, is controlled by Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. And needless to say, the Saudis were furious, and they said that the French had offended the most basic Islamic principles. And despite protest from French diplomats, they kicked the French channel off the satellite, leaving a vacancy for Al Jazeera. So Al Jazeera got the spot they wanted, became more receivable, and from then on they started to make a big noise here in the Middle East.
1998, Desert Fox Key.
1998 was the first big international scoop, because Al Jazeera realized early that there was great opportunity in Baghdad. Nobody else had a functional relationship with Saddam's regime, so Al Jazeera set up a bureau there in 1997. So in 1998, when the US and Britain bombed targets in Baghdad, ostensibly to destroy equipment for manufacturing weapons of mass destruction, Al Jazeera was there, and they were the only witnesses to show the bombs arriving, and that was their first big scoop. But in those early days, Al Jazeera made a conscious decision that it wasn't just going to entertain the likes of Saddam Hussein. It was going to welcome on to its show all kinds of groups who before had been excluded in the Middle East. For example, Al Jazeera invited on Israelis. This was an absolutely fundamental change from anything which had happened before, because Israelis were banned from Arab TV. Most Arabs had never seen an Israeli speak before. And here they were on Al Jazeera presenting their case in their own words. And of course, Arabs were astounded. They were amazed. They couldn't believe it, and they were very suspicious as well. They thought, you know, this has got to be a plot. You know, the CIA are behind this. This is run by Mossad. But it wasn't just the Israelis. Al Jazeera invited on Colonel Gaddafi. They invited on bin Laden, or they showed bin Laden videos, rather. They didn't invite him on the show. They had on Saddam Hussein. They had on Hamas. They had on Hezbollah, groups who are very, very important in Middle Eastern politics, but who had always been denied air time on other Arab channels because national Arabic channels, government channels, which had come before, had always regarded these groups as too pernicious an influence.
And what makes this different than a government channel, than simply state-run media, if it is established by the Emir of Qatar?
Well, the difference is that Al Jazeera is staffed largely by former BBC personnel, and Al Jazeera looks and feels, for people who don't speak Arabic, and everything in Al Jazeera is in Arabic, Al Jazeera looks very much like BBC World or CNN International. It's rolling news and It has investigative stories, and it really looks just like the news you or I are accustomed to.
That point of it being run by people trained by the BBC, in fact, a failed BBC Saudi effort, right, led to a lot of people being out of work and ended up here at Al Jazeera.
That's right. What happened is a Saudi channel called Orbit wanted to launch an Arabic news service. This was back in the early 90s, before Al Jazeera started broadcasting. And so the Saudis financed a BBC Arabic news service, and it lasted 18 months before the cultural differences between the Saudi financiers and the BBC staff proved just too much, and they had one row after another about editorial standards, because the Saudis were very sensitive about anything which made the Saudis look bad, and the BBC were obviously much more liberal than the Saudis and weren't prepared to be told what to do. So in the end, the Saudis pulled all the financing, the whole show fell apart, and a whole bunch of Arab journalists and administrators were left out of a job. And fortunately for Al Jazeera, which was just starting up at this time, they could just step in and employ them. And that's exactly what they did. They employed a very substantial number of these BBC-trained Arabic journalists, and many of those went on to be the stars of Al Jazeera today.
We're talking to Hugh Miles, who is the author of Al Jazeera, How Arab TV News Challenged the World. So 1998, Desert Fox, then the Second Intifada.
1998 was the first big scoop for Al Jazeera, but it still wasn't really famous in the Arab world. Its breakthrough in the Arab world came in the year 2000, during the start of the Second Palestinian Intifada. And this was really when Al Jazeera became a household name in the Arab world. And incidentally, it was still more or less unknown in the West. people were gradually waking up to it. Some of the big stars from Al Jazeera were sometimes making very small waves in the Western press, but no one had really switched on to it. And funnily enough, up until this point, the American government was actually very pro Al Jazeera. If you look at the State Department report on Qatar for the year 2000, in other words, just before 9/11, you'll see that it lavishes praise on Qatar, and it's a very praising of Al Jazeera as well. And U.S. officials often used to say that Al Jazeera was a beacon, it was a pillar of democracy. But of course, all that was about to change 180 degrees after 9/11, when the Bin Laden tapes started coming out, and when Al Jazeera started to report the extent of civilian casualties in Afghanistan.
And what were the images coming from Afghanistan?
Well, Al Jazeera was the only television news outfit in Kabul when the war started, right after 9/11. And Al Jazeera's management had been very far-sighted in that they had established a bureau in Afghanistan, in Kabul, more than a year earlier. The Taliban had actually approached both CNN and Al Jazeera and said, would you like to set up a bureau? CNN said, no, we're not interested, because the international, they didn't think there was going to be any news in Afghanistan. But Al Jazeera decided that it was a worthwhile investment. And of course, when the war started, it paid off. Because Taysir Alooni, the Al Jazeera correspondent who's now serving 7 years in jail in Spain, was the only international correspondent in Kabul, and he ran report after report showing the sharp end of the war, if you like, in Kabul, which was pretty graphic. There were civilian casualties, there were hospital scenes of dead civilians and children. And the kind of reports Al Jazeera were turning out directly contradicted what Donald Rumsfeld in particular, but other members of the Bush administration, were saying about this being a clean war. So they were very, very angry with Al Jazeera, and specifically with Taysir Alooni, over the kind of images he was putting out, because it put a big strain on the coalition, on Muslim allies. The images from Al Jazeera were reproduced in Saudi Arabia, in newspapers, and in Pakistan. And, of course, the people there were horrified that this was that they had signed up to a coalition that was killing Muslims in Afghanistan.
And then Iraq, the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
By the time the U.S. Invasion of Iraq had come around in 2003, Al Jazeera was a household name, and they invested very heavily in Iraq, and their coverage of Iraq, once again, was often exclusive. Al Jazeera had reporters in Basra and in Mosul, where nobody else was. And after day three of the war, by which time all the American news networks had left, everyone was depending on Al Jazeera for pictures. Fortunately, all the American news networks, or most of them, including CNN and Fox, have sharing agreements with Al Jazeera. And despite the fact they often like to complain about Al Jazeera in public, behind the scenes, they compete very hard to befriend Al Jazeera, to use their contacts, use their pictures. And that's exactly what they did during the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. We're going to break. And we come back, we will, in addition to Hugh Miles, be joined by Dr. Faisal Al-Qassim. He is perhaps the most famous of the Al Jazeera journalist. He has a weekly program called The Opposite Direction, one of the last to interview Saddam Hussein. Controversial around the world. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Doha, Qatar, from the headquarters of Al Jazeera. One of the most famous programs on Al Jazeera is called The Opposite Direction, similar to CNN's Crossfire. The Opposite Direction is a political debate show that features guests with opposing points of view debating a controversial theme. A common format of the show is to put an Arab dissident living in exile against a representative from that country's government, with explosive results. Airing every Tuesday for 90 minutes, The Opposite Direction is one of the most popular shows of its kind in the history of Arabic television and one of the most controversial. In fact, as Hugh Miles writes in his book, Al Jazeera, the show has been the source of numerous international disputes and instigated the severance of diplomatic relations with several neighboring countries. The anchor of The Opposite Direction, Dr. Faisal Al-Qassim, has become one of the most famous faces in the Arab world. He writes and researches every show single-handedly and books every guest himself. He's the author of the book Memorize and Shut Up, The Lost Art of Arab Dialogue. Dr. Faisal Al-Qassim joins us today in Doha. Welcome to Democracy
Now! Thank you very much indeed. Most kind.
It's good to have you with us, along with Hugh Miles, who wrote the book Al Jazeera. You had the last interview with Saddam Hussein before the U.S. invaded.
Well, actually, together with the general manager of Al Jazeera, I was the last journalist to see Saddam Hussein. That's right. We interviewed him for about 2 hours, hours and 10 minutes in one of his palaces, Al Fao Palace. But sadly, the interview did not go out because it wasn't, some of it was taped, but the rest of it was not taped.
Why not?
Well, because he did not want the interview to go out, as simple as that. But we had the time to sit with him and talk about a lot of things.
Like what?
All sorts of things, actually, about his ideology, about, how he is going to face the American invasion if it happens, and so on. We even talked about his cigars and women and so on and so forth.
What do you mean, cigars?
Well, actually, I remember at one point, I was showering him with hard political questions, so he was really fed up, sort of. So he said to me, well, why don't you ask me probably on about nice women, for instance, and let me talk to you instead of talking about politics, let me talk about cigars and how he used to, smoke cigars when he was in prison. And when, for instance, he asked me, what kind of, do you smoke? I said to him, no, I don't smoke, actually. He asked the general manager, he said to him, I smoke, but I smoke the small cigars. So he said to him, look, my dear, if you want to smoke, smoke something big. Smoke the Hubble Bubble, smoke a pipe, or smoke a cigar. So he gave us two cigars. I still keep one.
What were the hard questions you were asking him?
Well, the hard questions, actually, I asked him about, in particular, actually, about Ba'athism and Arab nationalism in particular, because, I said to him, well, actually, I think you have done Arab nationalism or pan-Arabism, if you like. You have done it harm more than anybody else. So I was challenging him over his nationalistic views. And he, in actual fact, he took quite a lot of time to talk about Zionism. Zionism, particularly the influence of Zionism on the United States of America. And I got the impression that the president knew quite a lot, actually, about the Zionist influence on the U.S. For instance, at one point he said to me, look, the Zionists are now in the United States of America. Once the United States of America starts falling down, they will go somewhere else. If Japan becomes, for instance, a superpower, the next day they will be there. So he was sort of obsessed with Zionism.
What about the issues you take on a regular basis? Can you talk about some of the more controversial interviews that you have had, causing you to have death threats from, well, all sorts of places?
Well, actually, we try to tackle things which happen now. As you know, too many things are happening in the Arab world these days. For instance, over the past year, for instance, we did quite a lot on Iraq, on the American invasion of Iraq. I remember I did something a couple of weeks ago, actually, and it created a hell of a lot of problems. We did something about the elections, and I had somebody on the program to talk about Sistani. You know, I mean, the Sistani, as far as the Shiites are concerned, is a holy man. Nobody can touch him. But I had somebody to tear him in two pieces. The next day, we switch on the Iraqi televisions to find that Iraqis are on the streets in their thousands, shouting at Al Jazeera, threatening Al Jazeera, particularly myself, actually. And they composed many songs, if you like. They are on tapes to criticize Al Jazeera and the opposite direction and so on and so forth. Thankfully, I mean, this is our 10th year, but we are still doing, as far as the viewership is concerned, we are still doing very well because, as you know, the Arab area is full of hot events.
How many viewers does Al Jazeera have?
Well, as far as I know, actually, but we don't have an exact number, but we have at least 35 million viewers. Some people say between 35 and 70. We know for a fact that everybody in the Arab world watches Al Jazeera. Yeah, because Al Jazeera has become, over the past 10 years, the main source of information for the Arab people. I mean, if you look at the Arab world before the emergence of Al Jazeera, the Arab people used to get their news and information from Western sources, particularly from the BBC, Radio Monte Carlo, and the Voice of America. Nobody used to listen to any Arabic radio or television. And there is a nice joke by the Syrian comedian Dureid Laham. He lives in one of the remote villages in Syria. So he said to his friend, switch on to the BBC to see what's happening in our village. So, which means that the Arab world used to depend on Western media. When Al Jazeera emerged on the media arena, if you like, things began to change. For the first time ever, we have a public opinion, an Arab public opinion formed by Al Jazeera, because Al Jazeera has become the national channel for all Arab countries from Mauritania to Damascus.
Today at the Al Jazeera Forum, one of the commentators talking about Al Jazeera said in the 10 years that Al Jazeera has been on the air, they have not criticized the corruption of an Arab government. Mm.
Well, actually, this is not really true. I would like to talk about my program. I mean, to begin with, six Arab countries withdrew their ambassadors from Doha because of my program. They were protesting against what was said in the program or on the program. So this is not really true.
Ambassadors to Doha, Qatar.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they severed diplomatic relations with Qatar because of the program. Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Tunisia, Libya, Morocco, and so on and so forth. And many Arab countries closed down our bureaus because of Al Jazeera. Why have they closed down their bureaus and severed diplomatic relations with Qatar? To protest against what we said. We said horrible things about the corruption of these governments, about the suppression they exercise over their people, and so on and so forth. So it's not really true that we haven't tackled corruption. We have tackled corruption. We have tackled all sorts of things.
Yeah. Hugh Miles, you've written it's as if these ambassadors think they are ambassadors to a TV network.
Indeed. I mean, Qatar is such a small country with a population of just a few hundred thousand, half of whom are under 18, maybe a third of whom are members of the royal family. Al Jazeera is really the biggest thing to happen around here for a long time.
But wouldn't this indicate that these governments see Qatar, the emir of Qatar, as running Al Jazeera?
the ambassadors view that, and they complain to the Qatari government, or they used to, with some logic, because the Emir of Qatar is the principal financier of Al Jazeera, so they attack him. But the fact is, the Qataris aren't involved in Al Jazeera's output. There's an editorial team who are responsible, and so when these Arab ambassadors used to attack or complain to the Qataris about Al Jazeera's output, really they were wasting their breath. And to be honest, by and large, they've now given up, and most of the complaints to Al Jazeera are American or African.
Are these protests because of your program?
Yes. Well, actually, I know that Arab governments have lodged hundreds of complaints with the foreign ministry here in Qatar against the program and myself. And you said, as you said, many ambassadors were ambassadors to Al Jazeera because they had nothing else but to watch, to monitor Al Jazeera output, if you like. So I know they created a hell of a lot of hullabaloo against the program, but they have given up. Because, I mean, we haven't stopped doing what we used to do in the past.
What is your response to the U.S. government saying that you act as a mouthpiece for Osama bin Laden or for terrorists running these tapes?
Yeah, very good indeed, actually. I wouldn't go far in answering this question. I just refer you to Hugh's book about that, actually. He, if you like, he measured the time we gave to Osama bin Laden and the time we gave to President Bush and his administration. And it's nothing. I mean, if we give 5 hours to Osama, if we give 5 hours to President Bush, we give Osama bin Laden 5 minutes or 10 minutes. So I think you can comment on that, actually.
Hugh Miles.
Yeah.
Well, it's absolutely true. Al Jazeera has given far more time just to American affairs, also to Israeli affairs, than they've ever given to Al-Qaeda. And there are plenty of videos from Al-Qaeda which Al Jazeera has never screened, which they don't regard as newsworthy. They're not interested in just broadcasting propaganda, so they lock them up, and that's that. But I should point out as well that there was an error, actually, in your initial introduction where you said that the Al Jazeera Bureau has been accidentally targeted twice. Well, it hasn't. It was being deliberately targeted by the Americans. After the bombing in Afghanistan, when fortunately no one was killed, General Tommy Franks admitted that Al Jazeera had been deliberately targeted because, quote, it was the site of known Al-Qaeda activity.
Let me ask you about your brother, who lives in Egypt. And then I also want to ask why you do this. Your life has been seriously threatened. Mm-hmm. What happened to your brother?
Well, actually, what happened to my brother? I remember once, for instance, let me tell you something, that over 200 volumes of writings have been written on the program. 99% of them are really negative, because the Arab governments had nothing to do but to tell their hacks, if you like, to write against myself and against the program. Hundreds of cartoons have been drawn. I remember in Egypt at one point, for 6 months, they had nothing to do but to attack the program. You open any Egyptian magazine or newspaper, and you find a piece or two or sometimes five criticizing the program. At long last, I think they said, well, actually, this is not really working. I mean, criticizing the program and doing cartoons. So why don't we to resort to something else? So I have a brother in Egypt. He's a pop star. So they sent him a couple of security men. They took him from his flat in Cairo.
He's a singer.
He's a singer. And put him on the first plane leaving Cairo. So they said to him, where would you like to go? We have three planes, one going to Amman, the other to Iran, the third to the Sudan. He said to them, why should I go to the Sudan or to Tehran? Send me to Amman. So the guy went to Amman with nothing with him, actually. He couldn't take even his pajamas. So he went to Amman, and I brought him to Doha. He stayed with me here for about 3 months, and then he went back. So it was some kind of punishment, if you like. I have been blacklisted, I know that for a fact, by many Arab countries. I can't go to many Arab countries. This is not going to stop us doing what we have been doing all along.
What is your mission?
My mission is actually, liberating the Arab world. liberating the Arab world from dictators and despots and horrible traditions, political, social, cultural, and so on and so forth. And I think we have succeeded hugely, thank God. I remember before doing this program about 10 years ago, I honestly used to think about certain political issues in the Arab world. And I used to look around thinking that somebody is eavesdropping on my thought. I was really frightened of even thinking. I used to behave like a child. We couldn't even think about certain sensitive issues. That was taboo. I have broken or torn to pieces all Muslim and Arabic icons, be they political, cultural, social, economic, and so on and so forth. Thankfully, we have slaughtered too many sacred cows.
And yet the fiercest critic of Al Jazeera is the United States.
Well, which is...
Which is a shame, actually.
But let me tell you something. I don't want to defend the United States, actually. It is true that the American administration has been exercising a lot of pressure on Al Jazeera. But it's not as much as the pressure exercised by Arab governments. Let me tell you something. An Arab leader once saw President Bush. He said to him verbatim, "Mr. President, you are sending too many missiles to Iraq and Afghanistan. Why don't you send one to Al Jazeera?" One of the Arab presidents, one of the Arab rulers, he's not a president.
Which one?
Well, I'm not going to mention his name, actually. But this is an example of how the Arab governments have been trying to pressurize the American government to pressurize Al Jazeera.
Hmm. Yeah. Finally, your last show and the next one are on Hamas.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
Well, actually, Hamas has achieved a landslide in the Palestinian elections, and it's not only a landslide, it's a turning point as far as democracy is concerned in the Arab world. Last week, I did something about Hamas, and I had two guys. One to say that Hamas, the victory of Hamas reflects the mood of the Arab street, if you like, from Mauritania to Lebanon. And if elections are held in any Arab country, the supporters of Hamas or the resistance movements in the Arab world would win, if you like. Somebody else was saying, look, this is a step backward, if you like. If you vote for these horrible people, it means you are going back to the Middle Ages.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Faisal Qassem.
Thank you very much.
He is the host of Al Jazeera's program, The Opposite Direction. We have also been joined by Hugh Miles, author of Al Jazeera, How Arab TV News Challenged the World. It has been published, is coming out in the United States, both in paperback as well as hardcover, and has been published in Britain as well.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll speak with an Al Jazeera correspondent who survived the U.S. siege of Fallujah, April 2003. We'll talk about that, as well as most recently as covering the Egyptian elections, where he was beaten very badly outside of the news headquarters. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Doha, Qatar, the headquarters of Al Jazeera, as we turn now to another of Al Jazeera's most prominent journalists, Ahmed Mansour. He was in Fallujah in April of 2004 during one of the bloodiest assaults by U.S. forces in Iraq. He reported from Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation. He was brutally beaten while covering the elections in Egypt just months ago. He's author of 17 books and is the host of a prominent talk show on Al Jazeera called Without Borders. We welcome you to Democracy
Now! Thank you very much.
It is good to have you with us.
And me too.
People in the United States have not heard very much about Fallujah, either what happened in November of 2004 or before that, April 2004. You're one of the journalists who were inside. What happened?
A lot of things happened. I think all of people around the world don't know, maybe only 1% about this has happened in Fallujah. When I was in Fallujah and the Al Jazeera team in April 2004, I hope that on this time, thousands of journalists is there for every street, every house, everywhere to introduce some of the truth or part of the truth to the people around the world. I think I stay 1 week, but all of things I did in Fallujah, all of things I introduced to the world via pictures and reports, maybe 1% only from these things happened there.
What did you see inside during that week that you were there? And what was the response of the U.S. forces to you reporting from Fallujah?
When I try enter Fallujah, every road to Fallujah closed. I try from maybe 7 road going to Fallujah, everything is closed. United States force was closed, everything. But when I lost in hope to go inside Fallujah. But I have a chance. I saw someone come with within desert between Fallujah and outside. I asked him, where are you come? He told me, I come from Fallujah this way. American forces don't know this way. I asked him to take me and my crew to inside. He refused in the first, but he agreed after that. We talked with him a lot of time. He agreed. Within 20 minutes, we become inside Fallujah. It is a good chance for us, and we are only our media team inside Fallujah. American forces, you know, this is don't allow to anyone to go out or go inside Fallujah, this siege around the city. It was there in Fallujah on this time, more than 300,000 people, women's people, this is population of Fallujah inside this. And after 2-3 days, everything become little, food and petrol and everything for life become electric from the streets. And this is crafts destroy a lot of houses because a lot of people fight for against United States force around the city. They destroy everything. Everything was destroyed, houses and a lot of things. Everything we introduced via picture and report to the people.
Everything you filmed?
Yes, everything we saw, everything we can, everything, every places we can go, a lot of places we can't go because this is battle between, this is guerrilla people and United States on some parts of the city, we can't go. But every place we can go to, this place we have picture for children, women, old people, and houses destroyed, and a lot of injured people and people killed. Everything we introduced via Al Jazeera. But I remember this is third day for siege. Family, 25 person, women, children, old people, killed via rocket. The rocket destroy their house and all family killed, only one survive. We have the picture and introduce it to the world. Everyone saw it.
So
it is only one case. You can imagine how a lot of people happen this on the more than of houses on Al-Fallujah.
So your images were countering what the U.S. military was saying about only killing insurgents. Your pictures ran counter to that. They told a very different story.
Yes. I think daily maybe we send from 30 to 50 minutes pictures from a lot of places from Fallujah. I have two cameramen and me, and we can go to everywhere, but when some people told us it is some rocket or tank is destroy some houses, we try go to this place and take some pictures and send it to Al Jazeera, and this is a broadcast to the world. Some of our cameramen went to this is some places and have some footage and some photo for this is battle between insurgents and American forces, but this is plane was destroy a lot of things and rockets destroy a lot of houses and people.
We're talking to Ahmed Mansour, one of the leading journalists of Al Jazeera, was there covering the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, covered the U.S. attack on Afghanistan, and then the invasion of Iraq was in Fallujah in April 2004. I have a question to ask about a man, an Al Jazeera reporter, who's being held at Guantanamo, Sami Al-Haj. Now, do you know him?
I know him like anyone. I don't meet him at all.
And yet you have learned that in the interrogations of this Al Jazeera reporter, they have questioned him about you?
Yes. It is the lawyer told me they asked Sami about you 100 times, more than 100 times.
Sami Al-Haj's attorney
told you? Yes. Not Sami Al-Haj. Sami Al-Haj told his lawyer. And the lawyer told me I had interview with him, and he told me they asked Sami about you more than 100 times. I don't know why, but I think they're very angry. United States, they're very angry with me from this is Fallujah battle. When at April 8, this is spokesman of United States Forces General. I remember him. I know him very well. He accused me on live. Ahmed Mansour is lie and all his reported is false. Spokesman of United States Foreign Ministry talk about me a second time, maybe April 17, and told Ahmed Mansour all his reports from Fallujah is false. So I become a number one of they maybe bought me. If Bush said that anyone not with us, he's against us, maybe they put me against them. But I was in Fallujah to introduce the truth to the people. This is my job and this is my work. I introduced picture to people to see what the United States forces doing when this is civilian people in Fallujah. So I think they try destroy me, destroy my job, destroy my life, because I am only there. I don't know why they ask Sami about me more than 100 times.
Ahmed Mansour, you also covered the elections in Egypt.
Yes.
This past, was it November? Can you describe what happened to you?
I should have an interview with opposition leader in Egypt, Dr. Nouman Gouma. I go down to Al Jazeera office to meet him outside. A lot of people come to me and check on me and some of people asked me photo, like any star working on TV. And another one come to me. I was talk to doctor to my guest on phone. I asked him, "How are you late?" Someone come and ask me, "Are you Ahmed Mansour?" I don't answered him, and I asked him to wait to finish my phone. After that, when I finish, he back again. "Are you Ahmed Mansour?" I told him yes. He began hit me on my face, and another one was behind me, put me on my head too. And they, before he hit me, he told me, "Why you talk about Al-Qazafi in your program? Bad words about Al-Qazafi." I think it is message to hidden who sent them to hit me. Within 30 seconds only, they hit me and run.
Uh-huh. So your face was very bruised.
Yes, yes. My face and my hair and my head too. I stay maybe 3 weeks under treatment.
And yet you went on the air.
I go, my program was after 20 minutes only. I go to my program and everything.
Completely a mess for
me. Yes, yes. I appear live on my program. I introduce complaint to Ministry of Interior Ministry. I told him, this is two people try killed me, maybe because they strong, too strong, and everything was planning very good.
So you issued a challenge on your program that night and demanded that the Egyptian authorities investigate who beat you.
Yes, they investigate, but everything is closed. Because I, this is week after, before this interview, my guest should be, this is Ministry of Parliament. And the government.
You believe that the Egyptian government was behind the beating?
I don't believe. I don't accuse anyone. But this is part of this story because some newspapers write about it. Maybe some people don't like Ahmed on the government and they do that. And this is some journalists around the world, let's say, to Egyptian government, asked him about this.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, though we will continue certainly to cover your story and to bring you tomorrow more on Al Jazeera. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ahmed Mansour, for joining us. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is broadcasting from Doha, Qatar. Our producers are Shreef Abdulkaddous and Anna Nagara here in Doha. Mike Burke, Shreef Abdulkaddous, and John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press. I want to thank Mei Ying Welsh, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.